Good morning. My name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'm the host of this new show, American Standoff. And I'd like to welcome you to this new KBUFM live show. So if you would like to call in, please do. Our number is, what is the number here? It is 503-231-8187. And this new show, American Standoff, will examine the current political divide in America today on January 6th, yes, from an indigenous perspective, given by myself, a native journalist based here in Oregon. And as you know, almost a year ago on January 6th, 2021, thousands of supporters of former President Trump gathered in D.C. and later stormed the Capitol, contesting President Biden's election. These insurrectionists included Proud Boys and their supporters, familiar to us Portlanders, as they have marched the streets of Portland armed and seeking confrontation in a city they view, our city, as antithetical to their beliefs. So I would just like to say good morning, Yat Eh. This is my own language in the Navajo language. Shea Jacqueline Keeler, Yinshia. And in the Navajo way, I wanted to kind of start this from my own cultural grounding. And so, you know, we introduced ourselves to our clans, and I'm a member of the Navajo Nation, I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, also known as the Diné people. And through my mother, and I am Yankton too, we are also called Dakota or Lakota. And in our own language, we call ourselves Yehontuan Dakota. Right? And my father is Yankton too, I should say. In Navajo, we would say Kia Ani Nishle. Yehontuan Dakota Bashin, Hashkanza Odashche, Yehontuan Dakota Doshanelis. And so this is the way in which I'm Navajo and also Dakota. So I just gave the sort of clan and tribal identities of all four of my grandparents. And so, as I mentioned before, I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, the largest Native nation in the United States. And it boasts a land mass the size of Ireland and has, well, and now has about 400,000 citizens. It really grew over the pandemic as more Diné people actually enrolled to get aid during the pandemic. And it's, you know, about the population of a country like Iceland, right? The Navajo Nation is also larger than more than 20 members of the United Nations member states. It's a country within the United States. And a year ago on January 6th, we all saw. And this is sort of why we're starting the show today. And we're going to spend the next 12 episodes looking at this. You know, what did we see on January 6th? And what does it mean today? That's going to be the focus of this series of shows. And so you know, join us every Thursday at this hour to kind of take another look at this. And we're going to be looking at it from an indigenous perspective. So what do we see? And do we understand? And when we hear this issue discussed, you know, what happened and why, what are the causes for the divides in this country, are we getting to the actual root causes, you know, and rather than looking at the sort of the symptoms or you know, going up, you know, just seeing the results, right? And in that year since, you know, what have we learned, you know? So I know last year when 2021 rolled around after a really difficult 2020, you know, we were all hoping and celebrating that this year would be different, right? We thought things would change, that you know, Trump was finally leaving the White House. And that has been a huge relief. I mean, not having to hear his voice every day. And I have to apologize. I will be playing a clip with his voice in it, so not to trigger people. And we finally had a COVID vaccine. You know, I think the first COVID shot had been taken just a couple weeks earlier from New Year's. And we were finally looking forward to leaving our homes and seeing our loved ones. I know that my mom got her first two doses of the vaccine, you know, at an Indian health clinic in Washington State. And immediately after I got mine here in Oregon, I rushed up there to see her. And it was just the one thing I wanted to do was to be able to hug her again after an entire year of being separate. Just 6 days later on January 6th, you know, we have a MAGA hat wearing, you know, a horde of Trump supporters storming the Capitol, you know, And at that point, I think I speak for everyone that we knew change had not come. The ship had not just naturally righted itself, the ship of state, and that we were going to continue to have to have that sort of force on us in America that has been pushing back against actual progress. This is everything from dealing adequately with a worldwide pandemic to climate change. And even as we watch our forests burn and animals and people lose their homes, and the very air we breathe here in Oregon, became unbreathable, for an entire more than a week in 2020. Still they push back. Still they are this constant force against actually addressing these really serious issues. It would seem like they are why we can't have nice things. Particularly for people of color in a white supremacist society, this has been historically true, and our families have borne the brunt of this this terrorism for hundreds of years, or even possibly, we could lose our planet in the very near future. And not only for ourselves, but for other living beings as well, I think, a lot of people in the country will say the four-legged, the two-legged, the winged ones, those who swim in the water, and the green growing things, the plants, and everything is at stake. And why? And I am going to in this series, draw the line between the origin story of the United States and the creation of the ideology of white supremacy in Virginia, in the colony of Virginia in the 1600s, to this present state of affairs. And I know that sounds like a really big jump, but, or maybe for some of you it is not, but I think it is a really necessary analysis that needs to take place. I am a journalist, and and what I see a lot of journalists doing is avoiding this question, avoiding the issue of white supremacy, and avoiding the issue of white identity, and the role it plays in exacerbating all of these problems that we face. So it's the elephant in the room that we won't talk about. And unless we do, because white supremacy is a structural problem in our society, and we can't change it unless we address it. And the fact that most Trump supporters are the vast majority are white, it does say something about this issue, and we're going to explore that more deeply. I'd like to once again, invite folks to call in and to be part of this conversation. We can discuss how you're feeling today. It has been a year. I hope that nothing that we're going to be playing or discussing is anyway traumatizing to people. I would like to make the sounds that we open with and things that could be quite disturbing. But please do call in. The number here is 503-231-8187. So once again, we were all hoping this year would be different, and it has not. We also see that they can't even be honest about it. They've been gaslighting us about what has happened, and even convincing themselves that these false stories are true. And this can be seen perhaps most graphically in former President Trump's description of the Capitol insurrection itself. Can you play that now?
I'm sorry, that's bonkers. Let's play that again and see for yourself.
There was such love at that rally, and they were peaceful people. These were great people. The crowd was unbelievable, and I mentioned the word love, the love in the air. I've never seen anything like it. You have people with no guns that walked down, and frankly, the doors were open, but there was also a love fest between the police, the Capitol Police, and the people that walked down to the Capitol, people who walked with no guns, with no nothing, and they're tremendous, in many cases, tremendous people.
Yeah, so that was the audio of Trump defending the insurrectionists and completely rewriting what happened. He grew up in that church, the church about positive thinking in New York City. The very American idea that the force of your mind can make you, powerful and you can rewrite create sort of reality around you, you know, create sort of a reality distortion field. And you see that at play here. And it has been very well received by people who were there, by people who are his followers. You'll see in interviews with people actually denying that the people who stormed the Capitol were Trump supporters, even though they're wearing MAGA hats. They're trying to claim, once again, it's Antifa, and even claiming that the famous QAnon shaman is not one of them. And so it's just complete denial, while at the same time still holding to the idea. You know, I think the latest surveys found that, you know, still even a growing number of Republicans believe falsely that the election was stolen and that Trump should be president. And so this is an issue that's not dying down. The last year has not, you know, gotten Trump followers to, you know, honestly own up to what happened and to do that. You know, the last 6 months we have had a House committee looking at this issue, and they've been slowly, you know, making progress. So some of the folks who stormed the Capitol have been sentenced. We have to recognize, as political strategist Donna Brazile wrote in the Griot earlier this week, that the insurrection was, quote, an effort to once again disenfranchise Black voters to pass 90% of their ballots for Joe Biden in the 2020 election. These are the kind of lopsided results that we're getting in the polling regarding the exit polling and the vote for president of the United States, which is that most of the people who identify as white, the majority of them, vote for Trump. And you see the complete lopsided response from communities of color, where you have, you know, 90% voting against Trump. And so it's deeply tied to the concept of race and racism in this country. And you know, that this insurrection was an active attempt to disenfranchise Black voters and other voters of color, including Indigenous and people of color. And so it's an actual assault on our rights to have any sort of participatory role in the decision making of this country. And I'm going to actually also discuss in this series a little each week a lecture I gave in 2017 and also in 2019, about this concept of the United States being a country. And I do question that, I have to say, because it's a colony, right? These are not the homelands of the United States. This is an ongoing occupation of homelands of hundreds of Native nations. And those Native nations, politically, many of them, fortunately, still exist to this day, whether they are recognized by the federal government or not. You know, so we persist. And this is an active, ongoing occupation. And so I believe that this sort of reframing of the situation makes a lot of things more obvious, right, about our situation right now. Why is it not changing? I mean, I think, you know, I grew up in a period where I was told as a child that they had solved all these problems, you know, that, you know, they had solved the issue of, you know, going into other countries and invading with Vietnam. That was a dumb idea. That women's rights was, you know, fought for and won in the 70s, and civil rights in the 60s, you know, for Black Americans. And yet we see so many ways in which the needle has not moved, right? Black Americans still have, you know, it hasn't, their situation has improved in many ways, but it has not improved in many other ways. And you can see that particularly in the reporting around redlining and wealth. You know, a Black family has substantially less wealth than the average white family, you know, by 150%. It's a huge amount. And even when you compare Black college educated families to white families with a high school degree, you know, the white family with a high school degree still has more wealth. And this shows that the distribution of wealth in this country, it continues to be predicated on race and racism. And so so that's why we're going to be discussing, you know, the issues of white supremacy, of white privilege, and of an ongoing occupation as the main factors that are driving the situation we see here today in this country. And so and we're seeing it in many different ways. And, you know, this violent armed response to the votes of people of color in this country. And this is coupled with the systematic disenfranchisement of BIPOC voters, Black, Indigenous, people of color voters. And that is through this voter suppression that we see happening, you know, as we're watching. There's a gerrymandering going on. And you know, even, you know, sadly enough, Trump was actually in charge of a census. You know, that happens only 10 years. You know, he tried to control, and that census determines, you know, political outcomes as well, right? You know, decides which states get more, you know, representation in Congress. And you know, so through voter suppression and not counting people of color in the U.S. Census, Trump's shenanigans with shortening the time people could be counted in the middle of a pandemic, you know, it's an attempt to hold back, you know, to maintain white supremacy. And I think that I'll go more into how he's directly sort of pushing those buttons, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, but we're laying out the sort of framework here. So some of it may seem repetitive. If anyone would like to call in, please do. I would love to hear your perspective. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. And this is a new show on KVU called American Standoff with me, your host, Jacqueline Keeler, and we're going to be looking at the issue of the political standoff in this country, and from an Indigenous perspective, a perspective of someone who is a citizen of a nation that is undergoing an occupation by a colonial occupation. My theory is that the United States is still a colony in function, if not overt stated form, right? It claims to be a country, but it really is still a colony. And what is a colony, right? A colony is, you know, what is a colonist, right? A colonist is someone who goes to other people's countries, occupies their homelands, you know, takes their wealth and exports it back to their ruling class, to their 1%, right? This is how you can define a colony very simply, right? And so I see these as algorithms, right? These are sort of, these origin stories are algorithms because they have embedded in them implicit rules, right? A behavior and what you're going to do and how you're going to operate. And this is why, you know, the United States is the way it focuses on utilizing the resources and the people within its boundaries that it occupies, why it does what it does, right? And, you know, I did a lot of reporting at Standing Rock in 2016 at the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance, you know, and with covering the water protectors in camp and everything in North Dakota. And I think a lot of time it was, you know, we sometimes forget that that happened under the Obama administration, right? The Obama administration, which was supposed to be, you know, the post-racial sort of, hope and change, I think, is what he ran on, right? And yet his administration, you know, oversaw, you know, sort of allowed this to happen, this militarized response to a Native nation invoking its treaty with the United States, right? And I say that, you know, the very county, the sheriff that was helping to lead that militarized response, was Morton County Sheriff Kritchmeier. That county exists in violation of the Fort Laramie Treaty, right? Treaties are international law, right? You know, tribes are recognized as nations politically and legally and under international law by the U.S. Senate when they ratify these treaties with them, right?
We have a call.
So, oh, great. We have a caller. I'll get back to that, the analysis of treaties and colonialization. Yes, caller.
Jen.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Jacqueline. I'm just really appreciate and
so grateful for all that you're doing. I listen to you whenever you're on with Paul Roland on the second Wednesdays, and I'm so happy and just it's awesome you have your own show now.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, if you heard on Paul Roland's Wednesday Talk Radio show, which I have been doing over the years on the second Wednesday of the month, we've talked about these issues before. What do you think? What do you think of, you know, maybe we need a new paradigm to understand what's going on to find solutions?
I think that you're right. I've been listening to you speak a lot and just different. I also listen to First Voices Radio on KBOO every week if I can. And I feel like there is needing to be a cultural shift, a huge paradigm shift. You know, I am a white woman, and I often struggle with how do I be a good ally? How do I affect change in a society in which it is so controlled by white supremacy and colonialism, which, you know, it took me a long time to get over the shame of being white in that way. And it took me a while to realize when Teocasin goes towards, talks about people having an indigenous soul, and it doesn't really matter what actually your race is now, if you have that same soul and heart for indigenous values that are just so needed, like to look at the earth as mother and everything here as our brothers and sisters and not the human as the most important, you know. I don't know, it's just so much, I think, to try to explain.
Yeah, I think it's, that's why I say that the focus should be on the structural issue, because as long as we focus on it being about blaming individuals, it doesn't seem to be addressing the real situation at hand. And also just seems to be, you know, I think obviously people have responsibility for their actions, right? You know, the storming the Capitol, actually committing violence against, you know, other people because of the color of their skin or their perceived ethnic identity or religion, looking at Muslim violence and you know, Asian violence on Asian, you know, all this violence that's been going on, it is a form of terrorism, and it's the way the state
I totally agree with you.
So thank you so much, Jen, I really appreciate it. And I will this is why I'm doing the show, because we have to figure out how to make this happen. I think we have to figure out how to be together as, you know, as groups of people, and to change the meaning, not to continue to live in a relationship built by a history that is hurting us. You know, it's hurting so many people. And how do you feel about the idea of being a colonist?
Yeah, I feel like I am, because I'm here on not my ancestors' traditional land, you know, and it's something I'm not proud of. It hurts me in a way, you know, to know that I'm occupying somebody else's land that they should be able to have and be able to be in relationship with.
I think, I don't mean to use that term to, you know, to cause pain, but you know, it is kind of the question at hand. If this is a colony, and then people who are not citizens of Indigenous nations are colonists, then one of the questions I asked in my lecture when I gave it was, what does ethical colonialism look like? You know, I mean, that's sort of the goal, isn't it? Some sort of ethical, moral sort of way of being, so that, but also I think there is some answers, which I'm going to look at in the episodes forthcoming, there are actually some answers in the historical relationship between a form of Western capitalism and the Oregon Territory, the Indigenous nations here in the Oregon Territory. And it's a really interesting history, and it actually has to do with the fur trade and the culture that was growing out of that was very different than what came after the Americans took over and quickly within you know, 5 years had put all the tribes on reservations. It was, you know, the fur trade, of course, had really bad outcomes, particularly for the beaver population and stuff. But it was an interesting coexistence of a colonial trade and also with recognizing Native nations and being sort of working together. And so I'm going to look at that. And I think that we can find ways of dealing with our history rather than constantly reliving it. No.
Yeah, I totally agree. I've really been listening to different thoughts and aspects about, you know, people bringing in more indigenous wisdom to, you know, real time science and how, oh my gosh, like who'd have thought? And for me, it just makes so much sense. Like, of course, the indigenous wisdom of to be with the land, it surpasses what, you know, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Forest Service and all BLM, all the destruction they're doing, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, I'm going to go into some of the history, particularly with the Army Corps of Engineers. I mean, my yeah. father's community was put underwater by the Army Corps of Engineers on our reservation and stuff. So
it's so awful and terrible. It's beyond.
Totally.
It's,
well, thank you for being my first caller, John. I really appreciate it, and I hope you keep calling in and listening as well.
Just like I said, I'm so grateful for all your work that you do, Jacqueline.
Thank you. Sorry. Okay. So I'm going to thank you. That was our very first caller for our show, and I really want to thank her. Thank you, Jen. So,
we've got John.
Yeah. Hello?
John on the phone.
Oh, hello, John.
Hello. I started listening a little late. I didn't catch your name.
Jacqueline.
Oh, that's right. Well, congratulations for your new show. What I wanted to bring up was a couple of things. This country was basically founded on lies that this land wasn't occupied by humans, just savages, and that slavery was a necessary evil, and God is on our side, all lies. God may be on some people's side, but he wasn't on the side of doing that, I'm sure. Or she, let's say.
Yeah.
Anyway, the other thing I wanted to mention was I remember as a little kid in Sunday school, they passed out around a quarterly pamphlet produced by some associated. Anyway, I was in a right-wing Nazarene church Christian Protestant church, and so this my memory of what I remember Pete repeated over and over in every issue.